Welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, the news director here at WCAI, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Sean.
And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner, Jeff Spillane of the Mashpee Enterprise, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times will call in, and we'll talk with Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, for the past several weeks here, we've been talking about the possibility that detained immigrant children crossing the Mexican border into the United States might be housed right here on Cape Cod, but we got news about that this week.
That's right. This set off a firestorm, as you know, on both sides of the issue. But this week, Governor Patrick announced that he had heard from the federal government that Camp Edwards or Westover would not be needed, that the number of children coming over the border has declined steadily over the last month, and they're actually closing a facility at Fort Sill in Oklahoma that had been opened. And so right now, it's stand down on this issue.
And it was quite a debate with rallies and protests. It was kind of a surprise how it really erupted.
That's right. There were two sides on this issue, and they were clearly defined. You were either for it or you were against it. There didn't seem to be a lot of middle ground on this particular issue. As you mentioned, there were protest rallies, and then there were rallies of support. In reaction to that, the Board of Selectmen made national news when they said they wanted to send a letter to Governor Patrick, and indeed did send a letter to Governor Patrick saying, we don't want this at Camp Edwards. We think it's going to be a financial strain to our community, even though they were assured by the state officials and the federal website that operates this program said that everything would be 100% covered by the federal government. That didn't appease the Born Selectmen, and they went ahead and wrote a letter saying that they didn't support this.
And that was a board with Republicans and Democrats on it. And then last night there was a meeting of the Democrat Town Committee in Born, and they have something to say about this as well.
That's right. Even though this decision was made a couple of days before their meeting, they decided to go ahead with their meeting, and they denounced the actions by the Board of Selectmen, calling it appalling. They plan to send a member to every Board of Selectmen meeting between now and the end of the year to raise the issue and say, look, what you did was wrong. You gave Bourne a black eye in this whole thing. Now, the selectman chairman, Peter Meyer, who happens to be a Democrat, by the way, says, look, this wasn't an anti-children vote. This was Bourne looking out for its finances, as all towns on Cape Cod are facing financial constraints. He said, you know, we just couldn't take a chance that this was going to be another promise not kept. Of course, Bourne over the years has educated military children who are at the base. That's been their responsibility. And the federal government doesn't kick in as much as it should. But the Massachusetts legislature has, over the years, filled in the gaps and given the town some money to help with educating those children.
So we've heard from the federal government. The children are not coming. We had that meeting last night, as you say, even after that announcement. Anything else, or is this pretty much wrapped up for now?
No, actually, there's a rally planned tomorrow. It was planned in anticipation of President Barack Obama arriving on the Cape and Islands. As you know, he's going to vacation on Martha's Vineyard again. And so this rally was planned at the Bourne Rotary, sort of to raise the issue as he's coming here to say, you know, we don't support using Camp Edwards. So I did hear from the proponents of that rally yesterday that they plan to continue because they don't think the issue has gone away. It's just slowed at the moment.
Is it a bigger issue for them? Is this they want to be part of really the national debate about immigration?
Right. Actually, what this whole issue did was spur that again. You know, it's been a debate for years, and this really ignited it again, especially here in Massachusetts.
Let's move on to the next story and talk about oyster thefts. When was this rash of oyster thefts? Was that last year?
Yes, this was the summer of 2013.
And some police work led to discovering not only who we now know was behind those thefts, but also what happened to the oysters, or at least some of the oysters. Talk about this.
That's right. This was Michael Bryant who actually stole the oysters, and he pled guilty last Friday, I believe it was, in Barnstable Superior Court to orchestrating these thefts, and he was sentenced to a two-year term for shellfishing violations, various things that he did. There's a hearing coming up on September 12th for restitution for the oyster farmers. Could be as much as $25,000.
Wow.
Now, that's not just oysters. Many of the oyster farmers that I spoke to over the last several months have said they lost equipment as well, because these oysters are they're in grants, and they float in these devices that once the oysters are out of them, they float away. So they've lost the equipment and their trays. And without the oysters in them, they float off. And so they're saying that they're owed as much as $25,000. And so there's going to be a hearing on that to determine exactly what the amount is. And Michael Bryant will have to make that restitution while he's on probation. He was sentenced to 2 years in jail to serve, and then he'll be on probation after that for 10 years.
It was such a big story because oyster farming is really one of the shellfishing in general is one of the bright spots in fishing here on the Cape, which, you know, is a storied fishing area. So people were paying close attention. And then when we learned from officials about who's accused of actually buying those oysters, talk about who that was.
Yeah, that was Joe Votto of Joe's Lobster Mart, and he pled guilty to receiving stolen property, which were the oysters, and he's now fighting to keep his license to sell shellfish. Been in business for 43 years in Sandwich, right there on the Cape Cod Canal, and a hearing is coming up on that on September 4th. Really, it's a last-ditch effort for him to convince the Department of Public Health that they shouldn't revoke his license.
So he went through the courts, but now he's got to face the regulators.
That's right. The courts have said the DPH, which Department of Public Health, is within its rights to revoke his license. So he's got to convince them somehow, and he'll be able to bring in character witnesses to say, you know, that this was a one-time thing and he deserves to stay in business, that there was no public health threat. You asked earlier, where did the oysters go? His attorney says that the ones that he was caught receiving from Michael Bryant went into the Cape Cod Canal, that when he found out that they weren't tagged properly, he dumped them in the canal. His business is right on the Cape Cod Canal in Sandwich.
Oh, I see. Interesting story, though. I mean, these oyster thefts led to the Votto story, as you say, very popular fishing mart there, lobster mart there. But also, the DA has somehow gotten pulled into this whole thing, too, because I understand he wrote a letter in support of Joe Votto, and now his political opponent, he's running for re-election, is making hay of that.
That's right. And Michael O'Keefe, who is the district attorney, would tell you he didn't write a letter in support of Joe Votto, that he wrote a letter because his attorney asked him to, and that he spelled out what was in the court record, the specific charges. Where that gets a little dicey is, well, the attorney already had the court records. He really didn't need the district attorney to repeat that. In his letter, Mr. O'Keefe takes the next step and says there was no apparent public health threat. And that's where some oyster farmers and his opponent says he crossed the line and became, instead of just writing this bare bones letter that spelled out the facts, to an advocate for Joe Votto.
He was making an assumption. He was advocate. I see.
And in fact, in the attorney's arguments before this court, if you will, he uses O'Keefe's letter and calls it a letter of support of Votto. So whether Michael O'Keefe intended it to be a letter of support or not, that's how it's being used.
Quite a story. And let's talk about another story that you've been following. You've been following, of course, the efforts of the Mashpee Wampanoag to get a casino built in southeastern Massachusetts. You've also been following the Aquinnah of Gayhead tribe on Martha's Vineyard with their efforts to get into the gaming as well. And we heard from a judge this week.
Yeah, this is kind of a fascinating story because what it is a difference of opinion between two leaders of two governments. You have Governor Deval Patrick, who's advocating for the state of Massachusetts, and you have on the other side you have Tobias Vanderhoop, who's the chairman of the Aquinnah Wampanoag, and it's all over whether the tribe has federal rights to game, to have an Indian casino on their tribal lands. The Aquinnah have said that they have those rights, that the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 1988 gives them those rights. And Governor Deval Patrick and the town of Aquinnah and a taxpayers association over there say, no, you don't have those rights. You gave up those rights when you made a land agreement with us in 1983 that was later approved by Congress in 1987. It's a complicated issue, but it's finally going to be decided in court. And what happened this week is a federal judge said that the town of Aquinnah and this taxpayers group, it's a community association of taxpayers and property owners in Aquinnah, other than the tribe, that they have a right to join that suit, that they belong as a party to that suit to protect their individual rights. And the reason he allowed that, well, the town was pretty simple. The tribe gave up its opposition of them joining the suit. So that was an easy decision for him. And the reason the tribe did that was there was a threat that the town would then file suit, just as the state of Massachusetts had done, and that would further delay the court action. Mm. So in order to get beyond that, they said, now let's allow the town to come in. In terms of the Taxpayers Association, it was a little bit more complicated for the judge, but he decided that because they were part of the original settlement agreement, that they should be allowed to come into the suit as well to protect their rights, that the state wouldn't necessarily adequately defend their rights.
Do we know what the tribe, the Aquinnah tribe, wants? Are they looking for a resort-style casino on Martha's Vineyard or something smaller? Any ideas?
No, it's something much smaller than that. They have an unfinished community building. It's right next to their tribal headquarters. They had hoped to build a high-stakes bingo hall there. Now, it's not bingo as you would go to the local VFW
right.
and have bingo.
Okay.
They actually do this through what appear to be slot machines.
Oh.
So for the unfamiliar, you go in and you feel like you're just playing a slot machine, and you're playing for the big pot along with other people.
Any time frame at all on this case?
The judge is trying to speed it up. He actually has a very ambitious schedule. He hopes to have summary judgment arguments by Thanksgiving and perhaps a decision by early next year on summary judgment. If it goes to a case, of course, it goes to a full case with witnesses and all that. It will take much longer. But this is the type of case that will probably be decided at the summary judgment stage.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. The Chronicle has a story this week about delays to the new fire station in Chatham because of pollution. Stay with us as the News Roundup continues. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, which is based in Chatham. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Big news, of course, in Chatham. New fire station. Communities work hard to get these fire stations approved by the voters and ready to go, and now there are delays in the actual construction.
Indeed. There were actually a couple new developments in this story this past week. Last fall, voters approved $10.3 million for the new station after a number of years of study. But because it will be built on the same site as the current station, fire and rescue operations are going to have to be relocated to the DPW facility on Crowell Road for the duration of construction, and temporary trailers to house those operations arrived this week and are now being set up. But we learned Tuesday that the construction won't begin for about 6 months more. It'll be delayed by about 6 months. And this is because of gasoline contamination that was found in the soil beneath the site earlier this year, which is believed to have come from underground storage tanks that were removed decades ago. But before construction starts, the existing station and two other buildings on the site have to be demolished, and a system to remove the contamination has to be installed. The project manager explained to the selectmen earlier this week that the demolition will have to be done in phases, beginning as soon as next week with the old community building, which is on the western side of the site, and slowly working its way east. After the community building, the old police station will be taken down, and the last one to be taken down will be the existing fire station. And, of course, they can't do that until they've all moved up to the DPW property. Once they've done that, the remaining demolition will take place, and that's all expected to take place by the end of September, actually. Then the groundwater cleanup system will be installed, and construction of the new station won't start until the spring to give them time to put in that system, and also they want to avoid having to put in new foundations during the colder months, so they've decided to move everything back to the spring. Now, how much this delay is going to cost is unclear at this time. The cleanup itself is going to add about $350,000 to the project. And there will be additional costs associated with the delay. According to the project manager, those haven't been quantified yet. It's going to depend on the bids that they receive for demolition, which were opened yesterday, and they got a number of bids, but those were being quantified and the amounts hadn't been released yet. They're going to have to appropriate additional money, of course, and the selectmen are expected to call a special town meeting this fall to address the shortfall. But exactly, as I said, how much that's going to be, we don't know yet.
Okay. Another story also in the Cape Cod Chronicle this week about sidewalks. Of course, sidewalks are always welcome in communities on Cape Cod, or not. What's the situation in Chatham?
Right, or not, in this case. Last year, residents along Stage Harbor Road, which is one of the town's oldest and it's very scenic roadway, like a narrow New England country road, they objected to the town's plans to install sidewalks. Initially, that was going to be done as part of the sewer project, which went down that roadway last fall. That has been completed, but they left room for sidewalks. But exactly what sort of design those sidewalks would have in the final stage was left unsaid. And at this point, town officials have finalized two different designs that they will present to residents at a public meeting this coming Tuesday. One design calls for a rounded granite curb between the roadway and the sidewalk, and the other a grass strip, which they think will kind of help maintain the more rural quality of that roadway. Now, residents don't want sidewalks at all. They don't think it's necessary. Officials say that it's a safety issue. It's a very well-trodden road. It's part of the loop that is regularly walked by quite a number of people. That includes Main Street downtown and Bridge Street. These plans also include extending sidewalks down Bridge Street, which hadn't been discussed earlier, and those will tie in with the new Mitchell River Bridge project, which is slated to begin at the end of this month. The state, of course, is replacing the Mitchell River Bridge, and they're going to put in new sidewalks either side of the bridge, but the town wants to tie new sidewalks along Bridge Street into that as well.
Okay.
Whether or not residents are going to go for these designs is sort of up in the air at this point. They've been available for them to view online, but there hasn't been much input from residents yet. That's going to happen on Tuesday, where officials will have some engineers there, and they'll be there to answer questions. That meeting is going to take place at 4 p.m. at the community center here, and we'll be covering that for the paper this week.
That's great. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. You can get all the details at the website, the Chronicle website. You can follow Tim and the Cape Cod Chronicle newsroom on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Sean.
Joining us on the phone is Sally Rose. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Sean.
There was a decision by the Provincetown Finance Committee this week talking about a split tax rate that would benefit year-round homeowners.
That's right. So the Provincetown Finance Committee, they've been paying attention to the recent effort in Mashpee to explore the state law that would allow them to reduce taxes for year-round residents, basically shifting that burden to non-resident homeowners. So Provincetown FinCom talked about that effort at its recent meeting last week, and directed one of its members to work with the town's finance director and town assessor to come up with a few tax exemption scenarios and also explore their potential impacts on the town. And they're expected to present their findings back to the FinCom in early September. And depending on the timing of the follow-up, it's possible that a proposed residential tax exemption model or maybe a variety of models could be brought to voters at a special town meeting in October, possibly as an effort to test the water, I'm thinking. And because this effort is likely to stir up some response reaction from both sides of the aisle on this. In Mashpee, 45% of homeowners are year-round residents, and in Provincetown, it's more like only 30%. One possible sticking point for some elderly residents who could benefit from the break is that the current state law caps the residential exemption at properties valued at $800,000 or less.
Very controversial in Mashpee, judging by the local paper and the letters being written to the editor there. And, you know, you talk about who's around to make these decisions.
Right.
An October town meeting, a lot of the year-rounders wouldn't be around.
October, often they will be. If you get a little bit later.
I mean the summer people, yeah.
Some of them.
Yeah, I see.
Yes, I think some of the second homeowners.
Right.
Who might be paying attention might not be around to sort of at least provide input, but I'm guessing that we'll start getting some this week.
I'm sure you will. Yeah, I of course meant the some of the part-time homeowners might not be around during those discussions, and I know that's what's happening in Mashpee. They don't want to have it in the dead of winter.
Right.
Right. Okay, and I understand the Provincetown Banner, your paper also has some information about the Provincetown Art Association and Museum's newest exhibit celebrating its 100th anniversary this year.
Right. This is the last exhibition in their four-part series that they've mounted over the last year. This series is called PAM 100, A Century of Inspiration. PAM, of course, stands for Provincetown Art Association and Museum. Each segment has encompassed 25 years, and this one covers 1990 to the present. And it's interesting, Christine McCarthy, the Art Association's executive director, she told us that in many ways this installation was the hardest of all to design, mainly because so many artists from this period are still alive, and they have more than 750 artists in the membership. She told us that she curated the show more aesthetically than historically and chose artists and work that showed well together and made connections with the whole. It opens with a reception this evening at 8 p.m.
Okay. And people can get more information from the Provincetown Banner website. Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Sally, thank you very much.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay. With me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter with the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. George, there was a story earlier this week about a man vacationing here on the Cape and got stuck with a hypodermic needle on one of the beaches. And then the paper has done some more reporting about that, talking to other communities about what are we seeing on the beaches in terms of hypodermic needles.
That's right. This was T.J. Connors. He was on vacation in Dennis and doing what we all do when we're on vacation, go to the beach, you kick some sand. And while he was kicking that sand, put his foot right into a hypodermic needle and honestly didn't know what to do. You know,
sure.
What do you do when that happens? And he went to the lifeguards. They helped him out with some alcohol swab and offered to call the rescue crew. He declined that, but he did go to the hospital, and now he's in for a series of shots to make sure he doesn't get things like hepatitis and to be tested for things like HIV. And you know, one day you're at the beach, and the next minute you're undergoing all these tests and getting shots. And
sure,
you know.
And the Cape Cod Times is Christine Legere went out and called some other communities on the Cape and said, "Hey, what are you seeing an increase as well?" And it's kind of mixed.
It's kind of mixed, but there are some communities where they're saying, yeah, we're seeing a dramatic increase in this. And, of course, we've done a lot of reporting on heroin abuse here on Cape Cod, and a lot of the law enforcement people tie this to that. They're finding discarded needles on beaches and parks and, in some cases, at cemeteries. I guess the warning here is that when you're out with your children, you know, just got to keep an eye on them and yourself, you know, make sure, you know, if you're going barefoot or something like that, that you're being, you know, cautious about where you're walking. And
yeah. It was interesting that Provincetown did not report an increase, and they attributed that to a really robust disposal system for hypodermic needles for addicts in that community.
That's right. And they also said there was someone from Provincetown who told us that one of the reasons that people are discarding these needles is that they're worried that if they get caught with them, that the police are automatically going to test them to see if there's drug use involved. Mm-hmm. And so that's why there might be some careless discarding of the needles across the Cape.
Okay, we're going to go to the phone where Jeff Spillane of the Mashpee Enterprise, a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise, is joining us. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Sean and George.
Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. Tell me, so there was a vacancy on the Mashpee School Committee after one of the members resigned. It's a little fuzzy, but apparently she was reading to some school children and kind of lost her cool, I think was the expression she used. And so the committee had to replace her. And when I asked you about this story, you said they did find a replacement, and it was a very American Idol type audition format. What do you mean by that?
It was Monday evening. It was a joint meeting between the Board of Selectmen and the school committee at Mashpee Town Hall. And there were four interested individuals in this open position. And each one of them was asked to come before the combined board meeting, and in 15 minutes, each had 15 minutes to talk about their background and why they were interested in this position. And then they each answered some questions from some of the board members. And when all four of them had gone through the process, they went around the table with the nine members. There were nine members from the both committees. And each one gave their reason as to why they thought this person should or should not be a school committee member. It was very reality show-like, very unusual. They didn't even go into executive sessions to discuss it. And in the end, the winner was a gentleman named Jeffrey Gorman. And I have to say he's Jeffrey with a G. I have to put that in there as well.
Okay.
He's Commander Jeffrey Gorman, who is a professor at the Navy War College in Newport. He also holds a Bronze Star.
Cool.
And being a career military person, he really has been moving around most of his career. And he came here to the Cape in 2009 to attend the drink program in oceanography with MIT and UWI, and said, geez, you know, this is where I want to lay down some roots. I have a child in the school system. And he really did give a wonderful presentation, and ended up getting the seat by a vote of 7-2. One thing that I did find interesting is that the two dissenting votes, the two that did not vote for Mr. Gorman, were both school committee members. So I hope that doesn't mean that they're off to a bit of an awkward start, and I hope that they can work things out as they start. He has already been sworn in, and he was at the table for the school committee meeting on Wednesday.
Okay. Another story in the Mashpee Enterprise this week about the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe is planning moving forward with a substance abuse treatment center. So that would be a treatment center in Mashpee for tribal members only.
Exactly. And planning is well underway. And, you know, like many communities across the Cape and Massachusetts, the tribe has been feeling effects of the prescription drug and opiate abuse epidemic that really has been sweeping across the nation. and Jesse Littledoe Baird, who is the tribal vice chairman. This is something she talked about when she was up for re-election in 2013, up for election in 2013. At the time, she said addiction could be wiping out my people, and we really need to do something about this. And so she's really been spearheading this project. And speaking with her yesterday, she talked about the disease of addiction being rampant in the community, and she feels a great responsibility to get this done as soon as possible. And it's very personal for her because she's lost a sister to addiction.
Oh.
So last month, a group of facilitators from the Department of Health and Human Services came to Mashpee from Washington to talk to the tribe about planning and strategy for this project. And there's already been some tribe members who have gone through a program at UMass Boston to become treatment counselors. And right now, the tribe is deciding, what do we want this facility to look like? Should it be a full-blown treatment center, or should it be more focused on aftercare to prevent relapse? Because the big issue is with the tribe, according to Littledoe, is that there's been many tribe members who have gone through treatment. They come back to Mashpee, the familiar surroundings and whatnot. It triggers relapse.
Right,
so
right
now there's a questionnaire that's gone out to the tribal community to solicit input as to what we want this to be in the community. And it's right now the working name for the center is called the Dream Center.
The Dream Center. Okay.
The Dream Center. And the reason, and I was not aware of this, but Cheryl Cromwell, who is also involved in this, she's Cedric Cromwell's wife and also a tribal council member, said that individuals who are really struggling with heavy, heavy drug addiction, they don't dream when they sleep. I did not know that.
Oh.
And so this would be a place to get clean and sober and dream.
I didn't know that either. Jeff Spillane is a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise. There's another story in the Enterprise. You can go to the website and find it about Mashpee Commons and an expansion there. You can follow Jeff Spillane on Twitter at G-E-O-F-F Spillane, S-P-I-L-L-A-N-E. Jeff, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
You're welcome. And on the phone is Jim Deruta. He's the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. I know we talked about doing two stories. I'd like to cut it to one. We're running a little late, but
yep.
If folks were interested in this this shooting outside of a bar in New Bedford, they should go to the website South Coast Today. And, of course, seven people were shot there. No arrests yet. But I was interested. A report shows that the annual per capita spending on fresh veggies in southeastern Massachusetts is $5.02.
Isn't that unbelievable? That's next to information that shows that Bristol County nationwide is number 32 in being able to sell it in selling direct market produce. So we're ranked really, really high. 98% of the produce that's harvested in Bristol, Plymouth, and Norfolk counties is sold locally directly to the public, and still just a measly $5.02 per capita.
Well, what's the problem? Are they not growing enough?
I would guess that's it. I suggest two little problems, supply and demand. you know, in the cities, there is so much room for community gardens and for farmers markets. And in a city like New Bedford, with so many empty mills, they could follow a pattern of a mill in Fall River that is raising salad greens, tomatoes, peppers in a mill powered by solar panels on the roof.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's a great story.
Yeah, well, the best thing about this, I think that the story that we had a couple days ago that would help the supply issue is there's an environmental bond bill waiting for the governor's signature with $5 million directed toward the Bristol County Agricultural High School to establish an Eastern Regional Center for Urban Sustainability. The Aggie School, of course, is raising farmers. It's a modern agricultural vocational school, but still it has vital greenhouse program, and it is in touch with the four cities in Bristol County. It gets most of its students from those four cities, Attleboro, Taunton, Fall River, and New Bedford. Okay. That $5 million, I think, would help both the supply and the demand.
Well, you may be right. You may be right, Jim DeRuta. Jim is the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com, and we appreciate his participation. Thank you so much, Jim.
You bet. Thank you, Sean.
And you can follow the New Bedford Standard Times editorial page on Twitter at OpinionSCT, and that SCT stands for South Coast Today. We're going to take a quick break, and we come back. We'll continue to speak with George Brennan of the Cape Cod Times and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times will join us. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI, where we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, the news director here at WCAI, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. George, Nopska Light, the lighthouse right here in Woods Hole, very, very popular, very scenic, and it's been up for sale, and now, what, the town of Falmouth is interested?
Yeah, the town of Falmouth is interested in licensing the Nopska Light. What the Coast Guard has said is they're still seeking buyers, but they'll also entertain the possibility of leasing the space to someone. And the town of Falmouth has thrown its hat in the ring. It would be a similar arrangement to what they've done with Highfield Hall, in that they would the town would license it, but then have another organization run it, perhaps even Highfield Hall. A few names have been thrown out, the Falmouth Historical Association and also the Woods Hole Historical Museum right here in Woods Hole. One thing the town doesn't want to see happen is that access be restricted to Nopska. They want to see it continue to be the type of place where families can go and sit out and watch a sunset, have access to the actual lighthouse itself and the history that that all brings. So very interesting that the town is looking at this and maybe having one of the organizations in town operate it.
And the Coast Guard has said that they want the same thing. They don't want it restricted either.
That's correct, but they just don't have the money for the upkeep anymore and want to get out of that business. The lighthouse, of course, still operates to help navigation in Vineyard Sound.
So. Of course. Okay, let's go to the phone where Nelson Siegelman is waiting. Of course, Nelson is the editor of Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Nelson.
Good morning.
So the first family is set to arrive on Martha's Vineyard this weekend. This is now a pretty regular occurrence. All the news outlets are doing stories about how the island is preparing, and it makes me wonder, is the island preparing, or is this just, you know, par for the course now?
I gassed up my boat in case I need to get away. That's about it. No, I don't.
Right.
August is so busy. The weather's going to be nice, I expect. There'll be lots of visitors here. The president stays in a very secluded house. He's well guarded. So except for those brief or, you know, unexpected encounters where he or members of his family go to eat or go shopping, pretty much it's summer as usual. I don't know that islanders do anything different. Certainly the police departments have to. It puts an added burden on all of the various departments because they have to be ready at a moment's notice to block roads or provide additional security.
I was going to say, I asked Cheryl Andrews-Maltes, who's the one of the tribe leaders for the Aquinnah, while she was in Boston. I said, do you expect to see the president over on Martha's Vineyard? And she said, yeah. And I said, really? You expect to have an audience with him? And she said, oh, no. I'm hoping to get in front of his motorcade and look in the rearview mirror.
Well, yeah, the motorcade's always impressive. You know, you see all these black cars racing by, but that's about it. And as I say, there are those unexpected moments. Somebody will be playing golf, and all of a sudden, there's the president. So we've received photos like that. In fact, generally, some of the better photos we've published have come from people who just had those chance encounters because, as you may know, the press corps is kept pretty much at arm's distance. President Obama is not like Bill Clinton in the sense that he's really gregarious when it comes to just wading into the public and hi, how are you, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and also I think it was Politico making hay about the fact Hillary Clinton is going to be on the island at the same time.
Well, sure. You know, if I were to make a list of everybody who comes here in late July, August, it would be pretty long. I mean, we get a lot of people who come here. Let's face it, in the summertime, you have a lot of wealthy vacationing people, and this is pretty prime hunting ground if you're looking for donations and that sort of thing.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Hillary, add her to the list.
And she's doing a book signing Wednesday at Bunch of Grapes.
Yes, I'm sure it'll be well attended. And, you know, it's part of, I suppose, the attraction for some people in August is to come to these many, many different events where you can hear lots of interesting people speak on a variety of topics.
Well, that leads us right to the next story, or one of the many stories in the Martha Vineyard Times this week. But this one is about some writers assembling on the island on Monday, some really well-known names there, and then some folks not too well, including myself and Mindy Todd.
You're on the undercard, are you, Sean?
The 8 a.m. get on the ferry by 6
sure.
card. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, this is going to be very interesting. This is being sponsored by the Martha's Vineyard Times. It's called Islanders Right. And from 8 o'clock in the morning until really 4 o'clock at the Grange Hall in West Tisbury, we'll have a long lineup of very accomplished writers talking about the craft of writing. And for those people not familiar with the Grange Hall, it really is a very intimate place for this type of event. It's not a huge hall. And there'll be a really variety of people. It's, I think it's going to be quite interesting. Tony Horowitz will be there,
mm-hmm.
Nicole Galland, Kate Pfeiffer, Mindy Todd will be speaking, John Huff, and the topics are going to be a whole variety of. There'll be plenty to hear about writing cookbooks, journalism to fiction, narrative nonfiction, writing for radio, writing children's books. But I think most of all, it's sort of fun to see these people in this type of intimate setting and be able to ask them questions just about the whole thought process. Anybody who's done any writing, I don't care if it's a long email, knows that, you know, it's not easy. You just don't sit there and knock it off if it's of any quality.
That's right.
And, so
writing is hard. It's hard pretty much for everybody.
It is hard work, no question about it.
All right, Nelson. Thank you very much. Nelson Siegelman is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Nelson.
You're welcome.
With me here in our Woods Hole studio, of course, is George Brennan, and he's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times. George, you cover the town of Sandwich, and there is a couple big proposals for the town of Sandwich we've been paying attention to, and they may make some progress. What are those?
That's right. The land is owned by the town. It's called the Golden Triangle, called that because it's located between Kituit Roads, Route 130, and Quaker Meeting House Road. And there are two proposals to purchase that land, one by a company that wants to build a big sports complex, a destination sports complex for youth sports. So the youth sports teams would come in, there'd be a hotel for them to stay in, there'd be ball fields for them to play in, or basketball courts, or soccer fields, whatever the sport is. And so they're looking at the land. And then there's a landowner that already has several plazas in the area, and he's looking to purchase it for a mix of retail, commercial, office space, and a little bit of residential housing. And he would redevelop the plazas that already exist there, sort of like a Mashpee Commons type development, or Pine Hills in Plymouth. And there is some talk. The two organizations have actually spoken about having some sort of a partnership amongst themselves as well. So, selectmen and an evaluation team are going to look at these proposals in more detail on Tuesday, a public meeting starting at 10 a.m. in the morning, going right through the day with a lunch break. And then on Thursday, the selectmen have scheduled another meeting. And there's a faction of the committee that wants to make a decision. They're ready to move forward. And then there are some who are saying, you know, we need to take our time with this. So we'll wait and see if they make a decision on Thursday, but some members are leaning that way.
Let's talk about Cape Wind. That's the proposal to put 130 wind turbines in Nantucket Sound, and that's been being discussed since the early 2000s. And I think the estimate now is they hope backers of Cape Wind hope to have the financing done by the end of the year and maybe start construction next year. But I think we've reported that several times over the years. So what's the story now? They did make some progress this week in their march to installing those turbines.
Well, this week they actually signed a contract with a builder. And they've announced builders before as well. But as their spokesman explained this week, that wasn't a done deal. There wasn't a contract. But now they have a contract with this company to actually do the construction, and they've lined up how they're going to do it. Still some discussion about whether New Bedford or Rhode Island will be the port where, or maybe both.
Yeah, it sounds like it might be both. As launching areas.
So there was some progress this week, and but as you said, this is an incremental story.
It's the ultimate process story ever seen.
You know, the interesting thing is I cover the Mashpee Wampanoag, and of course their casino has, in some iteration, has been talked about almost as long as Cape Wind. So maybe, you know, it'll be interesting to see which one we finally get that concrete answer on first. Okay. I don't know if it'll happen in our lifetimes.
How can we know? In Brewster, they have a new recycling program. Now, this is something that's happened across the Cape. Much of the communities on the Cape, there's a landfill which has a recycling component. You bring your stuff there and you throw the stuff away or you recycle it. But Brewster's doing something a little different.
Right. They're doing a pay-as-you-throw program. That's where you buy these specialized bags. You have to use those bags. And when you're tossing your bags into the landfill, a town worker is probably taking a peek to make sure you're not slipping in a white Glad bag. But what towns have found that have gone to this is it increases recycling, first of all, and cuts down tremendously on the tonnage of solid waste that they're then shipping off Cape, whether it be to CMAS or the new facility that's going to open up in New Bedford. And it's a tremendous cost savings to the community. Now, there's also a number of people who go to private pickup as well. That's not as well documented in all of this.
Right.
Sandwich, which is another community that has gone to this, has found that they're saving as much as $300,000 a year in reduced tipping fees because people are throwing away less.
And that is more is being recycled, which would be a good thing. In my community of Mashpee, where I have to pay for pickup, I called my haul away company and they said, oh, yeah, we'll pick up your recycling, too. But we're going to charge you more to do that. And and that's not the way it's supposed to work. So I end up bringing it to the landfill myself. So it's a confusing thing. There's no uniformity across the Cape, right?
No, there isn't. And you know, Brewster has recognized nearly $50,000 in savings. They don't have a full year under their belt yet, but for a small town like Brewster, saving that amount of money is a lot. I mean, that's the salary of a school teacher, perhaps.
There you go. Okay, I want to thank all my guests. George Brennan, reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. George was nice enough to come into the Woods Hole studio today. Thank you, George.
Thank you, Sean.
You can follow George on Twitter at GPB227. What's the P for, Patrick?
Patrick.
All right. And thanks for our contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner, Jeff Spillane of the Mashpee Enterprise, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times, and we spoke with Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.